This is the Nietzsche Podcast. If I were to suggest a use for philosophy, I would argue that perhaps its best use is as a tool for uprooting weeds. Let's assume for a moment that the psyche, the mind, is something like a patch of earth, and that within our minds we have all sorts of plants that are growing in there, and where the germs for these plants come from, it may not always be obvious. Much that's within the mind remains deep beneath the soil, beneath the surface of our consciousness. All of us would like to imagine that, at the very least, we are competent gardeners of our own mental soil, and that only those beliefs and opinions and sentiments which we planted there and that we nourish, only those are allowed to grow there. But the reality is, perhaps unfortunately, that the ecosystem of the mind is not so consciously planned as we'd like to imagine it. All sorts of invasive species make their way into the psyche. And our minds are cross-pollinated, so to speak, with all the other garden plots around us, all those other individuals, and their beliefs and their opinions. Things were planted in us before we were born, or before we were old enough to have any understanding of what was being planted. In short, most of us walk around with the ideas of other people in our heads. And while this certainly doesn't mean that everything we receive from our culture and from our upbringing is negative, it does mean that it is a somewhat natural inclination for human beings to passively or even unconsciously accept any number of what we might call common sense notions. Here in modernity, we are more or less comfortable with admitting that this sort of passive receipt of ideas occurs when it comes to, for example, moral judgments. It's easy enough to see how a social animal such as a human being would naturally mimic the moral beliefs of other human beings around them, to whatever degree. And whatever you think about morality, I would say most people are on board with that idea. But this doesn't stop with morality. Suppose there are prejudices with even deeper roots. Suppose these prejudices are not simply moral, or that they don't only concern themselves with human behavior and the social mores. Suppose that we have prejudices that constitute a kind of received wisdom as concerns the most basic facts of reality. That when it comes to not just how to act, but the nature of reality itself, we are operating based on a series of beliefs that we've simply passively accepted. Philosophy finds its use here. It's an activity in disabusing ourselves from believing in truths that we've received as common sense wisdom with no other justification beyond that simple fact. Philosophy, in some sense, begins when we start to take note of the ways in which even the most mundane assertions and statements of opinion contain within them metaphysical beliefs, and that these metaphysical beliefs have simply been allowed to grow within your garden without you even taking note of it. Now, suppose that among such received beliefs that you possess are included beliefs that are in fact errors. Mistakes, perhaps owing to an inherent flaw in human psychology, or whatever the case may be, and that nevertheless such a mistake has simply been allowed to propagate, or even been called self-evident. This is what we would call a weed. We could, in fact, characterize the various great philosophers according to which weeds they set themselves the task of uprooting. So with Socrates, the unquestioned way of life of the Athenians, set by religion and tradition. Descartes, the prejudice that the external world and our perception of it can simply be taken for granted. Rousseau, the faith that civilization has improved mankind. Hegel, that things are things in themselves, separable from the things to which they are related, and so on and so forth. We've defined all these philosophers by what they're attacking, right? In some sense, philosophy always begins with an attack on a view that the philosopher has realized to be nothing more than an assumption, an unquestionable assumption because it's assumed by so many. As we all know by now, Friedrich Nietzsche was a prodigious critic, and if we are to say that philosophy begins at this point of attack, you'd also have to say, few philosophized as hard as Nietzsche did. He never declared peace. His critique of modern thought begins in his first book, and it continues through to the very end. His targets are numerous. Among the assumptions that he attempted to weed out are, well, morality itself, or the notion of a true world, an intelligible world behind the senses, an intuition that begins in philosophy but becomes passively accepted through religion. Nietzsche also attempts to uproot nihilism or world weariness, sentiments that Nietzsche believed were suffused throughout modern culture. Already, these are sort of like titanic, monstrous weeds that Nietzsche has decided to wrestle with. Today, we're going to take a look at one of those critical passages in Nietzsche, which is in Twilight of Idols. Many of the sections contained in Twilight of Idols are Nietzsche's attempts to summarize or condense ideas that he'd written about for over a decade by this point. This section is no different. It is called The Four Great Errors. I've discussed this section a long time ago on the podcast, in the episode on free will, and I think it's been brought up in one or two other episodes over the years. But this passage is important enough on its own to warrant its own discussion. It was relevant to our discussion on free will because the Four Great Errors is the most significant passage for comprehending Nietzsche's view on that subject, above pretty much all other passages in Nietzsche's corpus. And in The Four Great Errors, he attacks free will, but without falling into the determinist camp. The reason he doesn't fall into that camp is because the criticism in The Four Great Errors is targeted at our whole mental framework of cause and effect, or rather, the way in which cause and effect are applied in our thought. Nietzsche can't be a determinist because he's not even convinced that our will is bound within an infinite net of causes. That would be the normal determinist critique of the libertarian free will doctrine, but it would still fundamentally be the same error. And while Nietzsche doesn't quite come up to the point of denying causality altogether, he calls into question all of the commonplace habits in our thinking about causality that color the way that we make sense of reality. That what we designate as a cause and what we designate as effect is often an arbitrary distinction. Usually the reason for distinguishing the cause from the effect accords with some kind of psychological need or inclination, rather than what might be a sober understanding of reality. Furthermore, we often reason backward to determine the so-called cause of a given event. The mind will invent causes where one is not immediately perceptible. Free will is merely one of the erroneous thought processes that Nietzsche draws our attention to in this passage. But in fact, this type of error goes all the way down to our very conception of being, of a reality full of quote-unquote things that are consistent, unitary, coherent. In other words, existence or beings. Again, one of those apparently self-evident truths contained within that word being that nevertheless has metaphysical implications about reality itself, and that we nevertheless all use on a daily basis because it's baked into the structure of our language. So first, I'll list off these four errors, and then we'll get into the nuts and bolts of the passage, in which Nietzsche explains what he means by each and gives examples. The errors are as follows. 1. The error of confusing cause and effect. This is quite straightforward. We believe something is a cause when actually it's an effect. 2. The error of false causality. That is, we believe something is in a causal relationship when in fact it only accompanies the so-called effect, and that we've not actually established a causal relationship. 3. The error of imaginary causes. We invent causes based on a sensation or a mental state, And Nietzsche says that this is in order to justify that mental state. And finally, 4, the error of free will. A specific example of such an error in our causal thinking. And on closer inspection, the error of free will points to a more profound error, that we establish such cause and effect relationships, such as the ego causing one's actions, because of a psychological necessity. The perceived consequences of believing in this causal relationship, the consequences of holding the belief, or the consequences of not holding the belief, that's what actually motivates the belief itself. Our perceived or imagined consequences of if we hold the belief, what happens? If we don't hold the belief, what happens? What are the consequences for humanity? So, confusing cause and effect, false causality, imaginary causes, and then freedom of the will. With that introduction, let's look to the passage. The beginning of the 4 great errors concerns the error of confusing cause and effect, and Nietzsche explains this error through the example of Alvise Cornaro. So, Cornaro is a writer and an architect during the Italian Renaissance period. He's born in the 15th century in Padua, although the exact date of his birth is disputed, and I bring this up because it's disputed for an interesting reason, which we'll discuss in a moment. But Cornaro is born sometime between the 1460s and the 1480s, and he lived until 1566. Although he's related to a noble family from Venice, Cornaro is merely the son of an innkeeper. He would sort of draw upon that relation to nobility because of the prestige of it. But, you know, in fact, he's from a lesser branch of the family. But he's able to take what little money his family had and became a rather successful entrepreneur. He's a somewhat interesting character, actually. He had little scientific training. He attended university in Venice, but he dropped out because he felt that the education he received was overly philosophical. It was disconnected from practical knowledge, which tells us something about him right there. He made his fortune by obtaining permission to attempt to reclaim land from the lagoon near Venice on the Adriatic Sea. So what Cornaro does is he successfully applied the science of hydraulics to turn this portion of the lagoon into wheat fields and fishing ponds. This is good for Cornaro as a business venture, and it's good for the city because the lagoon, it causes swarms of insects in the summertime and winter fogs. It smells terrible. There's just all sorts of problems. It's much better to have wheat fields and fishing ponds next to your city than, you know, a stinky, hazardous lagoon. So, after this, Cornaro publishes a treatise on water management, and he would go on to become a patron of the arts with the wealth that he made from ventures like this. And he is credited with introducing the Roman Renaissance style of architecture into northern Italy. None of this is why Cornaro is of interest to Nietzsche, by the way. Nietzsche's fascination with the example of Cornaro is due to a series of treatises that he published later in his life. Cornaro is known as a humanist to this very day because he attacked a prejudice that was common in medieval European society and had lingered. It was popular up to his own time. And this is the view that old age is nothing but a period of pain and decay. This is the harsh winter of life. The years that you spend as an elderly person are naught but suffering. And that this is in some way simply the natural order of human life, that you should expect this and endure it stoically, but just know that when you get to old age, it's going to be a bad time. You know, you can rejoice because your body is about to be rejuvenated in heaven, but it's more or less accepted that one's physical existence at the end of their natural life is, well, bad. Cornaro lives to a very old age, and he says, on the contrary, one's elderly years are the most beautiful period of life. He says that God wills all of us to live long and healthy lives and to live to reach this best age of one's lifetime. Because in old age, all of your accumulated wisdom allows you to see the world with new eyes or with a better, higher perspective than the youth have on life. And so Cornaro becomes a kind of health and longevity advocate, and he lives to either his 90s or to be over 100 years old. His exact age when he dies is disputed because we have various birth dates for him, with some sources saying he was born in 1464, although it seems more likely he was born in the 1480s. That's just my belief that as Cornaro becomes a sort of guru on longevity, people begin to overestimate his age. It becomes exaggerated just how old this man lived to be. That's not an unusual phenomenon at all. It's very common among, for example, Taoist sages or Zen masters in the East. In any case, he did live to a very old age for somebody living in the 15th century, and so we finally come to the main point on which Nietzsche will use Cornaro in order to demonstrate a great error in thinking. Cornaro began to suffer from gastrointestinal problems and feverishness when he was around 35 years old. His doctors advised him to eat a very sparse diet, and Cornaro restricted himself to 12 ounces of food a day. Bread, egg yolk, meat, and soup, and 14 ounces of wine every day. So when he was in his 80s, he was asked to write a treatise on his secret to longevity, and Cornaro attributed his good health to this diet. And Cornaro genuinely believed that liberality in one's diet, you know, gluttonous consumption of food and drink, he says this is contrary to the will of God. And this is evidenced by the fact that it shortens your life. By living virtuously, by consuming only the caloric intake that you absolutely need, one earns a long life. And it's worth noting, aside from this religious or moral dimension of Cornaro's thought, this popular wisdom of caloric reduction would remain in the zeitgeist for hundreds of years afterwards. This was true up through Nietzsche's time. The popular wisdom that Nietzsche calls Cornarism is not really overturned until the 20th century. And so now the passage. Nietzsche writes, quote, "Everyone knows the book of the famous Cornaro in which he recommends his slender diet as a recipe for a long and happy life, a virtuous one too. Few books have been read so much. Even now, thousands of copies are sold in England every year. I do not doubt that scarcely any book, except the Bible, as is meet, has done as much harm, has shortened as many lives, as this well-intentioned curiosum. The reason? The mistaking of the effect for the cause. The worthy Italian thought his diet was the cause of his long life, whereas the precondition for a long life, the extraordinary slowness of his metabolism, the consumption of so little, was the cause of his slender diet. He was not free to eat little or much. His frugality was not a matter of quote-unquote free will. He became sick when he ate more. But whoever is no carp not only does well to eat properly, but needs to. A scholar in our own time with his rapid consumption of nervous energy would simply destroy himself with Cornaro's diet. Crede experto." End quote. And that last line means, believe him who has tried, credit the expert. So implicitly, Nietzsche is tying himself to the type of the nervous, modern, scholarly type. At least he was at one time during his professor days. So again, who says that Nietzsche can't take a shot at himself every once in a while? In any case, as we've discussed many times on the podcast, Nietzsche spent quite a lot of time experimenting with his own diet. He believed there was a very real link between your overall physical and mental health, and that one's daily habits, your daily intake of food, you shouldn't simply go about these things thoughtlessly. The question of Nietzsche's own diet and his views on diet are somewhat fascinating, but the key point to understand about this is that Nietzsche has come to understand something that I think most nutritionists today would agree with. There is no universal diet. Now, this doesn't mean there's no definite claim that we can make about what is healthy and unhealthy in general. But different people have different physiological needs, different lifestyles, just different restrictions on what they can or should eat for their best health. And Nietzsche learns that through firsthand experience. He also sees how the eating habits of European countries differ dramatically, such as when he compares the eating habits of Germans to that of the Italians and so on. As a result, he's able to see that Cornaro's diet can't be a panacea, that in fact, it was right for Cornaro, but that it would not be right for many others. And if this is the case, this means that Cornaro's diet may have shortened a few lives rather than lengthened them. That people with a higher caloric need might have fallen victim to thinking that, you know, Cornaro's diet is the cause of his longevity. As I noted earlier, this isn't a critique of cause and effect as such. In fact, Nietzsche says that Cornaro's longevity is the cause of his diet, if you pay attention. That's actually a very funny claim. But he makes it quite clear. A slow metabolism is the cause of a long life. This kind of thinking in Nietzsche, by the way, goes all the way back to his lectures in the Pre-Platonics, where he references the thought experiment by the philosopher of science, von Baer, in which it is imagined that pulse rate correlates with one's experience of the passage of time. That is one hypothesis that, as far as I understand, has not been borne out in terms of modern scientific knowledge, as Nietzsche's insights on nutrition perhaps have. But that said, this colors Nietzsche's thinking. There's a speed to one's physiological existence. That we can measure the existence of a phenomena, in some sense, by the tempo at which it manifests. But if Cornaro's metabolism is what causes his long life, his slow rate of metabolizing sort of equates to a slow and long-lived existence, then that means that his physiology, what he is what accounts for his dietary needs. And in spite of all the unanswered questions that still remain concerning diet even to this day, it seems quite clear that on an epistemological level, the causal relationship has not been established here. That if we are to admit that one's diet depends on their physiology, then is their physiology not the cause of their optimal diet rather than the optimal diet the cause of the state of their physiology? We could, of course, say that living at variance with your optimal diet could be the cause of an early death, or living in accord with your optimal diet is the cause of a long life. But in that case, couldn't we just take the argument a step further? Why can't this person eat only according to their ideal diet, right? Maybe somebody really needs to have just red meat and potatoes and vegetables. And, you know, why is it that they're always eating junk food? Well, maybe they have no impulse control. Okay, so why do they not have good impulse control? Isn't there a physiological reason for that too? Something about just their nature that makes them crave junk food, and so on, right? It's very hard to draw the line at a certain point and say, this is the final cause. That's one of the things that's sort of implicit behind this critique of our causal thinking, is that in some sense, it's always arbitrary where we say, no, this is the cause. Somebody can always come along and say, okay, but what's the cause of that? And this answer doesn't satisfy us with our common sense wisdom, right? Why is it not satisfying? It's because we've been taught a certain mental framework throughout our whole lives that tells us exactly the opposite. And Nietzsche says that this radical idea here is pointing to this very error is the first example of his revaluation of all values. He writes that, quote, the most general formula on which every religion and morality is founded, quote, do this and that, refrain from this and that, then you will be happy. Otherwise, end quote. That's what Nietzsche calls the original sin of reason in this passage in Twilight of Idols. But I should note here that this tendency in thought was observed by Nietzsche as early as Human All Too Human. It's what he characterized there as one of the most common false conclusions arrived at by human reason. For the sake of comparison with the four great errors, let's look at section 227 of Human All Too Human, where Nietzsche writes, quote, Christianity, which was very innocent in its intellectual ideas, demanded faith and nothing but faith, and passionately rejected the desire for reasons. It pointed to the successful result of faith. You'll soon discover the advantage of faith, it suggested. You'll be blessed because of it. The state, in fact, does the same thing, and each father raises his son in the same way. Just take this to be true, he says. You'll discover how good it feels. But this means that the truth of an opinion should be proved by its personal benefit. The usefulness of a teaching should guarantee its intellectual certainty and substantiation. This is as if the defendant were to say in court, "My defender is telling the whole truth, for just see what happens as a result of his plea. I am acquitted." End quote. So, Nietzsche's point here, in Human All Too Human, is that the proof for a given proposition in this formula is the happiness that the proposition creates. Do this and you will be happy. Believe this, you will discover how good it feels. The church called this the proof by pleasure. Nietzsche's point in Human All Too Human is much more straightforward than it is in the Four Great Errors passage in Twilight of Idols. In Human All Too Human, Nietzsche is simply exposing the fact that this is a paralogism, a false syllogism, that does not serve as proof of anything. Nietzsche's point here is simply, this reasoning is false. It's incredibly common, but nonetheless it's false. Another example of human fallibility in reasoning, often covered over by moralizing, driven by a psychological need. So it's typical of the critiques we find in this book. Our reasoning here is human all too human. In the Four Great Errors passage, this proof by happiness is examined on another basis. The fact that the proof by happiness is a confusion of the effect for the cause. Why is this? Because, like with Cornaro's diet, in which slow metabolism, you know, a physiology with natural longevity is actually the cause of one's sparse intake of calories, Nietzsche argues here that one's happiness is the cause of their virtue, not virtue the cause of their happiness. That some people are, by their very nature, by their very constitution, happy. The reason why a person lives happily is the same reason that they live virtuously, because of what they are. Which means that once again, when we promise that virtuous living creates happiness, we're reasoning based on a causal chain that we haven't actually established. Nietzsche writes in Twilight of Idols, quote, "A well-turned-out human being, a happy one, must perform certain actions and shrinks instinctively from other actions. He carries the order which he represents physiologically into his relations with other human beings and things. In a formula, his virtue is the effect of his happiness. A long life, many descendants, this is not the wages of virtue, rather virtue itself is that slowing down of the metabolism, which leads, among other things, also to a long life, many descendants, in short, to Cornarism. The church and morality say, a generation, a people are destroyed by license and luxury. My recovered reason says, when a people approaches destruction, when it degenerates physiologically, then license and luxury follow from this, namely, the craving for ever stronger and more frequent stimulation, as every exhausted nature knows it. This young man turns pale early and wilts. His friends say, well, that is due to this or that disease. I say that he became diseased, that he did not resist the disease, was already the effect of an impoverished life or hereditary exhaustion. The newspaper reader says, the party destroys itself by making such a mistake. My higher politics says, a party which makes such mistakes has reached its end. It has lost the sureness of instinct. Every mistake, in every sense, is the effect of the degeneration of instinct, of the disintegration of the will. One could almost define what is bad in this way. All that is good is instinct. And hence, easy, necessary, free. Laboriousness is an objection. The god is typically different from the hero. In my language, light feet are the first attribute of divinity." End quote. When I read passages like that one in Twilight of Idols, it's almost daunting to try and unpack it, as they say. Because Nietzsche has already condensed everything down to the finest, subtlest version of the point. But Nietzsche asserts here, virtue is an effect of happiness, which is a revaluation because it completely inverts the moralist narrative that happiness only comes as an effect of virtue. This is why Nietzsche says at the beginning of the Four Great Errors that this erroneous thinking is hallowed by the names religion and morality, because all religion, all morality is based on this proposed causal relation, where virtue is the cause and happiness the effect. Whether it is the Christian duty to turn away from your sins, or the Buddhist abandonment of desire, or the Muslim submission to God, whether it is the deontologist who speaks of moral obligations, or the utilitarian who preaches the greatest good for the greatest many, or Socrates telling us that eudaimonia arises from living virtuously. Really, it is with Socrates that Nietzsche finds the philosopher of this formula. Nietzsche writes in another section of Twilight of Idols, The Problem of Socrates, quote, "I try to understand the idiosyncrasy from which the Socratic equation, reason equals virtue equals happiness, could have arisen. The weirdest equation I've ever seen, and one which was essentially opposed to all the instincts of the older Hellenes." End quote. So once again, Nietzsche would probably suggest that his notion that happiness is the cause and virtue the effect is closer to the older Greekism, as he called it, the idea that the good man was good by nature, and thus acted good by nature, had good feelings by nature, had a healthy diet by nature, was virtuous by nature. And so to return to the Four Great Errors passage, this is why Nietzsche says that a god has light feet, because for the person with that natural goodness in them, virtuous actions don't come as a labor. They don't have to force themselves. They don't have to tyrannize over themselves in order to comport themselves in a just or admirable way, or to be generous or courageous people. If that is a burden, it already indicates a disintegrating instinct, a failing health. Nietzsche then gives a series of examples of the opposite, that one's health is not destroyed by vice, but one engages in vice because of their failing health. That applies on a societal scale. This is a point in Nietzsche that oftentimes, I would say both his reactionary interpreters and his leftist critics fail to understand. Nietzsche would completely disagree with anyone who thought that the answer to decadence, that is, the decline of a civilization, is to institute some program of virtue, that we're going to get everyone back on the same page, get everyone to begin acting virtuously again, and through this reinstill the old values of the dying or dead traditions, and that this will then rejuvenate our society. Because not only is this remedy sure to fail, on a deeper level, the entire proposition is based on that erroneous perception that vice, depraved behavior, sexual license, luxury, and so on, that these are the cause of society's downfall. Nietzsche says, no, the society's downfall causes those things. The reason? Physiology expanded to a grand scale. The declining physiology always needs greater and greater stimulation in order to feel anything at all. The same way we might compare to, you know, the taste buds of older people begin to wane. The same way you simply don't get the same thrill out of something pleasurable the thousandth time that you do it as you did on the first or the second time. Furthermore, errors in judgment, errors in thinking, mistakes, these are again sourced to be the cause of one's downfall, when really, Nietzsche's point is, if you had been on top of your game, you wouldn't have made the mistake at all. The mistake didn't cause you to fail. It's like when, in a game of chess, you say, you know, I lost because I blundered one of my pieces. But why did you blunder one of your pieces in the first place? You know, you might say, well, because I was tired, or I wasn't paying attention, or I based my move on an instinct that turned out to be wrong. Sometimes players who are on the verge of defeat just start to blunder piece after piece. They get irritated and they make riskier moves to try and regain the advantage, and they just lose piece after piece after piece. And so, too, with the political chess game, with the geopolitical chess game, you know, with a political party, they're defeated not because they politically miscalculated. They miscalculate because they're on the verge of defeat. So I think those are all very helpful examples. Now, we come to the second error, the error of false causality. In this error, Nietzsche probes a bit further into our whole manner of thinking about cause and effect, and he asks, where do we get our faith that we know what a cause is? And this is a serious logical challenge, I would think, to put to most people with such common sense notions in their head as to how they come to designate something as a cause and something else as the effect. Aside from however we might go about logically establishing this, Nietzsche says, if you want to know the actual reason why people possess this faith in causality, he thinks it comes from, quote, the realm of the famous inner facts, of which not a single one has so far been proved to be factual. We believe ourselves to be causal in the act of willing. We thought that here at least we caught causality in the act. Nor did one doubt that all the antecedents of an act, its causes, were to be sought in consciousness, would be found there once sought, as motives, else one would not have been free and responsible for it. Finally, who would have denied that a thought is caused, that the ego causes the thought? End quote. So this faith in causality, it comes from our own inner experience of willing. We perceive that our thoughts, our motives, have a cause, which is the ego, and that these motives then cause our actions. But as Nietzsche says, this is a faith, and that is because it's derived from an intuition. It's derived from a feeling, just a sense that we have that we're the cause of ourselves and the cause of our actions. But it's not established by evidence or reasoned argument. It was simply taken as a given that such inner facts are to be taken as true, because what could be more of an immediate certainty than our own perceptions and our own inner feelings? But Nietzsche thinks there's a mistake here. He says that the so-called motive is an error because it is, quote, merely a surface phenomenon of consciousness, something alongside the deed that is more likely to cover up the antecedents of the deeds than to represent them. End quote. And Nietzsche says of the alleged origin of our motives, the ego, that it has become, quote, a fable, a fiction, a play on words. It has altogether ceased to think, feel, or will. End quote. What Nietzsche means here is that the ego is a narrator which gives post hoc explanations for the actions of the organism, which in truth are, quote unquote, willed by impulses which are unconscious. This notion of the self, first seriously proposed by Nietzsche, would later be expanded into the psychoanalytic school of thought, led by Freud, carried on by Jung and many others. So the thinking, feeling, and willing does not originate in the ego in this new understanding. The ego is this self-image, this constantly self-creating narrator that is attempting to make sense of and justify the actions that are thought, felt, and willed by unconscious drives. So the ego is not the cause of motives. And motives, as the consciously articulated explanation for how we act, Nietzsche writes, quote, merely accompanies events. It can also be absent, end quote. So what is our justification for saying the motive is the cause? In other words, the motive accompanies the event, yes. The motive that we consciously narrate to ourselves accompanies whatever act or deed we are doing, but he says it can also be absent from it. That's a strange thought, taking an action but with no conscious motive. But nevertheless, I'm sure almost all of us have had something like this experience. When you do something and then later you come to the realization, I don't know why I did that. Right? Shouldn't it be impossible to have that thought? And yet many people have that thought. Perhaps if we know ourselves fairly well, you know, you might be able to come up with an explanation after the fact, but that wouldn't change having the experience of doing something without being conscious of our motives. And if that's the case, then could conscious motive really be the cause of action? Or is it merely an accompanying phenomenon, not the cause? So, in other words, an event happens, several phenomena occur, we have a human action, and accompanying that phenomenon, we have the conscious subject who is taking the action. We have the conscious subject's understanding of their motive for the action. What is the cause of the action taking place? Nietzsche says that by attributing it to the motive or to the ego consciousness, we've just leapt to an unjustifiable conclusion. In light of Nietzsche's new appraisal of the self that would become powerfully influential on the psychoanalysts, Nietzsche writes, quote, "There are no mental causes at all. The whole of the allegedly empirical evidence for that has gone to the devil," end quote. But then Nietzsche goes on to suggest that this belief in mental causes is at the root of our notion of being. What do I mean by that? Well, when we designate a quote-unquote cause, we always have to essentialize events as things. The reason for this is that the entire mental framework of cause and effect has to separate the effect from the cause, or else it would be nonsensical. So it has to create a doer and then the deed, a subject and then the action the subject takes. But as Nietzsche argues in Genealogy of Morality, when he says that this is like separating the lightning from the flash, that's simply a grammatical faith. When we say the lightning causes the flash, we're saying nothing at all there. We're simply taking an event that happened, a series of sensations that we had. Maybe it's sensations of a routinely repeated and even scientifically understood phenomenon like lightning. But nevertheless, we're taking an event that happened, which is inseparable from the process that creates that event. It's all the same thing, one big process, one big happening, one big becoming. And we're distilling out of that a subject that does the thing. Further down in the passage, Nietzsche continues, quote, "All that happened was considered a doing. All doing, the effect of a will. The world became to it a multiplicity of doers. A doer, a subject, was slipped under all that happened. It was out of himself that man projected his three inner facts, that in which he believed most firmly, the will, the spirit, the ego. He even took the concept of being from the concept of the ego. He posited things as being, as a cause. Small wonder that later he always found in things only that which he had put into them. The thing itself, to say it once more, the concept of thing, is a mere reflex of the faith in the ego as a cause. And even your atom, my dear mechanists and physicists, how much error, how much rudimentary psychology is still residual in your atom," end quote. So when we slip being beneath everything, that is the creation of the doer that does the deed, the lightning that does the flashing, Nietzsche's suggestion here is that this is a kind of sly trickery. It's like a magic trick, sliding the card that the audience member revealed to you back under the deck, right? That's what we have done with all phenomena. All that is given about a phenomena is sensation. That's all we know of the world, what is given to us by the senses. And we are by no means justified in positing being on that basis. These sensations are caused by definite, separate things with their own essence. That is sort of the best I can do at positing the ordinary notion of being. But we create the sense through our language, through the creation of the thing, the subject, the object. This relates to atomism because the atomist is trying to discover, in some sense, the smallest thing, the bedrock of physical existence, the smallest possible particle, the smallest unit of matter. Because if we were to discover that, we could then say that something is real, something is existent in the way a Platonic form exists. The atom is this thing. The atom is that enduring unity that we always indicate when we indicate being. And thus, whatever you may think of atomism, Nietzsche's point here is that the same tendency to think of the world in terms of being is the same psychological undergirding of that atomist project. Fundamentally, this is the same thing that undergirds the theist's project. He's articulating the same faith when he makes spirit the cause of reality. God is the cause of reality. And here, that prejudice is articulated in the same form as its origin, reality as caused by the will of a thinking subject. That intuition of being a thing that thinks, that's the reason for this type of error, slipping that thingness, that being underneath the ego itself. And so we may say that in the second great error, Nietzsche's gone farther in critiquing causal thinking itself. The third error, that of imaginary causes, may at first appear to be less of an attack on causality than, you know, simply another misapplication of causality. But as we get into this third error, I think it will become clear there's a even further critique, an even deeper critique here as well. The error of imaginary causes is best exemplified by dreams. Nietzsche here, again, returns to musings, which he first put to the page in Human All Too Human, and which were later revisited by Freud in his work, The Interpretation of Dreams. It's a well-known phenomenon that dreamers will experience external stimuli of some kind, such as a loud sound, light flickering on their eyes, or, as is the case in some of Freud's experiments, being tickled with a feather while you sleep, and the dreamer will incorporate that sensation into the logic of the dream. Nietzsche writes, quote, "A cause is slipped under a particular sensation. For example, one following a far-off cannon shot, often a whole little novel in which the dreamer turns up as the protagonist. The sensation endures, meanwhile, in a kind of resonance. It waits, as it were, until the causal instinct permits it to step into the foreground, now no longer as a chance occurrence, but as meaning. The cannon shot appears in a causal mode, in an apparent reversal of time. What is really later, the motivation, is experienced first, often with 100 details which pass like lightning, and the shot follows. What has happened? The representations which were produced by a certain state have been misunderstood as its causes." End quote. So the interesting thing about the dreaming mind is the way in which a sensation is represented to the dreaming subject as a cause of events which are entirely scripted and represented by the mind alone, for the mind alone. That the events in the dream are not in fact caused by the cannon shot. The cannon shot is simply incorporated as the cause, as an event with meaning. The representations that were produced according to the logic of the dream come from the motivating drives, the entire cacophony of all the organs and impulses within the dreamer. And dreams also have that funny way of playing with time, as we all know from the film Inception, for example, in which some sense impression the dreamer receives can persist, resonate, as Nietzsche says here, and then be explained after the fact by the dreaming mind, which Nietzsche is comparing to the way that we represent the world. Our sense organs interact with our mind in such a way as to produce a representation. The representation, of course, comes after the initial stimulus. But Nietzsche says in The Logic of the Dream, this is precisely reversed. And where Nietzsche makes another radical claim, another challenge to the common sense wisdom, is in the following paragraph. Quote, "In fact, we do the same thing when awake. Most of our general feelings, every kind of inhibition, pressure, tension, and explosion in the play and counterplay of our organs, and particularly in the state of the nervous sympathicus, excite our causal instinct. We want to have a reason for feeling this way or that, for feeling bad or feeling good. We are never satisfied merely to state the fact that we feel this way or that. We admit this fact only, become conscious of it only when we have furnished some kind of motivation. Memory, which swings into action in such cases, unknown to us, brings up earlier states of the same kind, together with the causal interpretations associated with them, not their real causes." End quote. This, I think, is eminently relatable, because for one, I think it's fairly common. It's a fairly common experience that sometimes you just wake up and feel, for lack of a more descriptive word, happy. You're just having a good day, and you can't even find any particular reason for it. Or maybe you wake up in a bad mood, you know. You woke up on the wrong side of the bed, as we say, and then a friend asks you, "Why are you in such a bad mood?" And then what happens? You begin to search for reasons. Some sort of consciously experienced or consciously articulated cause for why you're in a given mental state or in a given mood. And the memory begins to present you with all these possibilities. Here's why you might feel that way. And as Nietzsche coins the phrase in Beyond Good and Evil, there might not be such a fine distinction between finding and inventing. finden and erfinden, as these words are in German. There's not as much of a difference between that as those two things as we would like to think. Now, it's worth noting that in some sense, one could make the argument that it's actually the point of memory to give you answers to the question, why do I feel this way? Like specifically answering that question, that's one of the main tasks of memory, because one of the main advantages of being a remembering organism is that when something isn't working for us, we can course correct. We can say, I feel bad all the time. What am I doing that's making me feel bad? And that's an indisputably useful function of memory, because an animal with no self-consciousness across time doesn't have access to that kind of self-awareness. It might know I feel bad in the moment. But if you can't string moments together and bring to mind the fact I felt bad every single day for a week now, then course correction becomes difficult, if not impossible. And so this is the main use of memory, is actually to ask that question. But this is where the Nietzschean critique of our notions of truth, given the context that we are biological creatures, that we're physiological creatures, this is where that comes into play, because then there's sort of a difficult question that is raised in the wake of this. Does memory actually establish a firm empirical foundation for positing causal relationships between external events and how we feel? All memory can do is correlate together all the times I felt a certain way and then ask what events preceded that. But can we actually say with certainty that the events that preceded the way we feel caused that feeling? And if we can't say that with certainty, which I think would follow from Nietzsche's argument so far, then tracing over all our past memories will actually not bring us closer to any sort of certainty. It will simply remind us of past interpretations we've made, past conscious explanations that we've given to ourselves post hoc as to why that we feel the way that we do. And if every one of those past interpretations was just as erroneous as the one prior to it, this kind of mental habit actually gets us nowhere. The truth for Nietzsche is that there's this whole interplay of forces in our physiology, that blind contest of impulses and drives. This is, in truth, why we feel the way we do. But because none of those causal factors are actually conscious to us, none of them are freely chosen, to say this, to bring this to our attention, as Nietzsche does, is the equivalent of saying, well, you simply feel this way, and that is that. But that's not satisfying, right? That explanation, or frankly, that non-explanation, is not satisfying. And why? Well, Nietzsche says there's a psychological explanation for why it's not satisfying, and it's fairly simple. To locate a cause is to make known the unknown. And this, quote, relieves, comforts, and satisfies, besides giving a feeling of power, end quote. When we're confronted by an event beyond our control or understanding, the least we can do in order to not feel overwhelmed by this is to explain why it is the event is happening, to give the event a meaning. Simply put, to remain in a situation in which we are surrounded by the unknown is terrifying, and the mind starts to grab for a cause in order to abolish the sense of terror, like sort of grasping at vines to claw our way out of that pit, right? And so Nietzsche writes, quote, first principle, any explanation is better than none, since at bottom it is merely a matter of wishing to be rid of oppressive representations. One is not too particular about the means of getting rid of them. The first representation that explains the unknown as familiar feels so good that one, quote, considers it true, the proof of pleasure, of strength, as a criterion of truth, end quote. We return to that old bad habit in drawing conclusions that Nietzsche wrote about way back in Human All Too Human, the proof by pleasure. Believe this because it feels good. In this case, because it abolishes that which feels bad, the sense of the unknown. It doesn't even have to be a good explanation. Any explanation that delivers us from the fear of the unknown, the first one that seems to work as a cause, we will pick that explanation as soon as possible so that we can stop thinking about it. Nietzsche goes on to say, of course, that we will adopt familiar causes over anything strange, over anything never experienced before. Whatever we have already inscribed into memory and labeled as a cause will be our go-to, and memory will habituate this kind of thinking as a heuristic for future encounters with the unknown. the lingering doubt, the mysterious, the unexplained. This is in many ways a torment. Causal thinking is a delivery from that torment, but that doesn't make it true. It just makes it pleasurable. See, this is the radical critique that Nietzsche is giving us about the structure of our thought, why we think the things that we do. As Deleuze would put it, truth is not an element of thought. Nietzsche here is saying pleasure is. The use of familiar, habitual thought patterns is pleasurable, which is why once this error in thought seeps into our thinking, we just continue in it insensibly. There's a dimension of this in our own individual psychology as well. Nietzsche writes, quote, "One kind of positing of causes predominates more and more, is concentrated into a system, and finally emerges as dominant, that is, as simply precluding other causes and explanations. The banker immediately thinks of business, the Christian of sin, and the girl of her love," end quote. This kind of habituated thought pattern is a common error all its own, albeit only a subset of this great error, but we've all seen it, I'm sure, the political activist for whom the cause of everything in life is political. Whatever the problem is, that was because of the politics of the other side. Whatever the solution is, or whatever good thing we have going on in society, that's because of the politics of my side. Every single problem is considered politically. Everything is assumed to be the result of this one system of causes, which is dominant in their thought, and so they ignore all the other causes. Or we might think of the paranoiac, a person who's dominated by paranoid suspicions and fears. They have an internal problem. They have their own pathology, their own excessive glut of fearful and suspicious feelings, but they find the causes of those feelings projected onto the external world. I'm fearful and suspicious not because I'm paranoid, but because I'm being followed, right? Anything that happens in such a person's life can be explained by some malevolent external force, some person that they're suspicious of, and on and on. Carl Jung's notion that everything within the psyche that remains unconscious becomes projected onto the world and seen as a sort of external force or external actor, that idea bears mentioning here because it resembles Nietzsche's idea in this passage. Everything beneath the surface of consciousness is worked into the same familiar framework and projected onto an external cause. Nietzsche goes on to argue that, quote, "The whole realm of morality and religion belongs under this concept of imaginary causes," end quote. And what Nietzsche means by this is quite clear when we look at the concept of sin. How would Nietzsche regard sin, given the critiques he's made so far about our causal thinking, our misapplications of causality? Well, he says the feeling of sin is, quote, "slipped under a physiological discomfort. One always finds reasons for being dissatisfied with oneself," end quote. This kind of critique harkens back to the genealogy of morals, in which Nietzsche says that the priest tells his flock, "You sickly sheep, you are to blame for your own suffering." Nietzsche wonders in that work how it is that such a sick ideology, such as the ascetic ideal, could ever take hold. And this third great error is one of the elements of that, the dismal workshop of the psyche that Christianity establishes, in which guilt is actually heightened. The individual is made to work at making himself feel guiltier and guiltier. This workshop gets going with the fuel of ressentiment directed by the priest, but its operations follow the formula as laid out here in the error of imaginary causes. That is its structure. That is to say that the individual suffers and without an explanation feels his suffering to be meaningless. It's part of the unknown, right? The discomfort of the unknown is 1,000 times more painful than the suffering itself, the sense that one's enduring a kind of meaningless suffering. The priest gives the parishioner's suffering meaning. That is his great benefaction to mankind in a way, that he can make their suffering meaningful and thus eases the pain of suffering by attributing it to a cause. Now, the entire mechanism of this, in Nietzsche's view, is very bad because it multiplies the suffering in order to deal with the suffering. But that's neither here nor there for our purposes in analyzing this passage. The key point is that by giving the suffering meaning, the priest is engaging in this thinking based on imaginary causes. and that it's better to have this imaginary cause than no cause at all. Nietzsche finds that this prejudice is right there in the work of, for example, Schopenhauer, his once great influence, whom he later rejected. Nietzsche quotes World as Will and Representation, quote, "Every great pain, whether physical or spiritual, declares what we deserve, for it could not come to us if we did not deserve it," end quote. Nietzsche criticized this aspect of Schopenhauer's thinking, once again in Human All Too Human, where he said that we tend to think that because a sensation exists, there must be some justification for it. The word deserve in Schopenhauer is really an attempt to legitimize or justify suffering. Why? Well, in order to give it that much needed meaning. What does it mean for suffering to be deserved? Well, it means there was some way that it could have been prevented, some way of acting or being that we did not properly fulfill, and as a result, we must suffer. And Nietzsche argues that reveals the truth of morality. As a poisoner and slanderer of life that it is, morality always has this idea behind it, of treating the suffering of life as a punishment for wrong action. Meanwhile, good feelings, good conscience, happiness, that's all conceived as the reward for the consciousness having done good deeds, of having acted the proper way. You used your will to obey the laws of God and so on. And so good feelings are the reward for right action. Bad feelings are the punishment for wrong action. You know, again, the pleasure in these ideas is in giving a meaning to the entire human psychodrama of feelings and sensations. Nietzsche raises an issue with this as well, though. He writes that the so-called good conscience is, quote, "a physiological state, which at times looks so much like good digestion that it is hard to tell them apart," end quote. In other words, the reason you're in a good mood is probably because you had a good wholesome meal and no indigestion while metabolizing it. You say the cause of your happiness is your virtuous deeds. Nietzsche says the cause of your happiness is your gut. He also takes issue with what he calls a naive fallacy, that happiness comes from the successful completion of some enterprise. That, in other words, you know, we reach a goal that we've long tried to attain. You complete some meaningful task or project, and that's what makes you happy. Nietzsche says, quote, "the successful termination of some enterprise does not by any means give a hypochondriac or a Pascal agreeable feelings," end quote. So, to use the example of Blaise Pascal, it seems quite probable to me that Pascal was never happy. Or rarely, if ever, happy might be a more measured way for me to put it. Pascal was an extreme depressive. He writes extensively about just how horrible it would be if it turned out that the only existence were this world. this world of impermanence and suffering, right? That the human condition is like being one of many chained prisoners simply awaiting our execution. That we're like a mote of dust in a chaotic universe whose scale is just beyond any comprehension. These kinds of terrifying existential thoughts are always sort of storming through Pascal's mind. And they don't go away when he completes some task or personal challenge. They don't go away when he, achieves his salvation of his soul through Christianity. Or so he believes, right? If anything, these feelings are heightened now when Pascal becomes a Christian, because he begins to fear for his own salvation. And he writes that salvation is uncertain, even for the martyrs, up until the time when you face, the justice of God or so on and so forth, whether or not you find out that God will extend his grace to you. We might say the example of the hypochondriac is also instructive here. Types with sustained high anxiety, the actual circumstances of their lives don't matter that much in terms of regulating the state. You know, their brains just always invent some reason why they need to be freaking out, because there's always at least some possibility that you ought to be freaking out. There's always could be some medical reason lurking within your physiology that you haven't become aware of yet. You can always come up with something if your brain is dead set on worrying. So again, attributing the cause of your worrying to some definite event or external force is an imaginary cause. And that becomes very obvious with such terminally anxious people, that they simply have something wrong, something that's malfunctioning with their brain that's making them anxious. And that, in fact, the searching for the imaginary causes of their anxiety is actually part of the anxiety. It's actually part of that anxious brain cycle. Similarly too with depression. Depressed people aren't sad all the time because every single day of their lives is a never-ending tragedy of just horrible, calamitous things. It's because they're incapable of being happy. That doesn't mean that that situation can't change, by the way. I'm not saying you're doomed to depression forever. That's not what I'm saying at all, by the way. I'm not saying there isn't a solution for their depression. It just means that blaming external circumstances for a repeated, sustained feeling that's happening inside of your head, that is rather obviously a mistake, and it's actually part of that whole pathology, is to make those projections. Nietzsche writes, quote, "In truth, all these supposed explanations are resultant states, and as it were, translations of pleasurable or unpleasurable feelings into a false dialect. One is in a state of hope because the basic physiological feeling is once again strong and rich. One trusts in God because the feeling of fullness and strength gives a sense of rest. Morality and religion belong altogether to the psychology of error. In every single case, cause and effect are confused, or truth is confused with the effects of believing something to be true, or a state of consciousness is confused with its causes." End quote. And so at this point, we arrive at the final great error, free will. In many ways, free will exemplifies all of these errors in thought that we've previously considered, but Nietzsche lists it as a special case, and I think because from free will we can infer what it is that sets this entire erroneous thought process into motion. The germ of the idea of free will, Nietzsche alleges, comes from what he calls the foulest of all the theologians' artifices, so the worst thing that the religious thinkers have ever created. This is the notion of responsibility, which makes the subject dependent on the religious caste. This is because responsibility is what sits at the foundations of all morality. This is what we have been articulating throughout this examination when it comes to the tendencies of all moralities and religions to promise happiness in exchange for quote-unquote good behavior, and to promise punishment as the wages of sin. Responsibility is the concept required for all moralism, without which the moral interpretation of human life just simply falls apart. And why do we consider human beings responsible? Why are we responsible for our actions or for our will? This is because of the belief in the doctrine of free will. Free will, responsibility, these concepts are more or less the same thing. We might ask a simple question, therefore. Why seek responsibility? Why would we create such a concept, assuming that it is false, as Nietzsche says? Why would we have this notion then? Quote, "Wherever responsibilities are sought, it is usually the instinct of wanting to judge and punish which is at work. Becoming has been deprived of its innocence when any being such and such is traced back to will, to purposes, to acts of responsibility. The doctrine of the will has been invented essentially for the purpose of punishment. That is, because one wanted to impute guilt. The entire old psychology, the psychology of will, was conditioned by the fact that its originators, the priests at the head of ancient communities, wanted to create for themselves the right to punish, or wanted to create this right for God. Men were considered free so that they might be judged and punished, so that they might become guilty. Consequently, every act had to be considered as willed, and the origin of every act had to be considered as lying within the consciousness." End quote. So this passage is important in light of the fact that Nietzsche has attempted to make sense of human life with what he calls an economy of principles. That is to say, the greatest possible explanatory power, in the fewest possible principles. If human life is to be understood naturalistically, then where do we get the notion of free will? Here, as elsewhere, Nietzsche says, the answer is will to power. The priestly class, the ascetic types, they create free will, they create moral responsibility because it's a means of wielding power. It makes the individuals of the community responsible, and not just responsible in some sort of abstract sense, responsible to the priest, who is the intercessor between man and God. If man thinks that there is right action and wrong action, and that he's morally responsible for choosing right action over wrong, he will naturally ask the priest, how should I act? And if he's acted wrongly in the past, he'll go to the priest and ask to be absolved. The priest attained power over the flock by making them guilty. As Nietzsche writes further down in the passage, quote, Christianity is a metaphysics of the hangman, end quote. That is the aim of this doctrine of responsibility, which is substantially identical with the doctrine of free will. And Nietzsche writes that the priests and theologians continue to infect becoming, which is nature in its pure innocence, with this guilt. That this is, in some sense, the ugliest thing that the human animal does, and that the human animal does uniquely. It introduces guilt into innocent nature, innocent becoming. To Nietzsche, therefore, free will is not simply a doctrine that expresses a common sense truth about the world. It was a weed that was planted in us all for a very specific purpose. And perhaps all such ideas, all such beliefs are planted for a similar such purpose, to motivate a certain kind of behavior, to express the power of a given drive within mankind. This doctrine of responsibility, if we examine it in light of a naturalistic understanding of the world, is a strange and unique thing. It doesn't really fit with the rest of our comprehension of nature, where we never perceive, we never look for responsibility. We don't see responsibility in the cosmos and the orbiting bodies slamming into one another or flying off into the abysses of space. The one place that we find it is in ourselves, due to what we call these inner facts, actually conscience, or an intuition that has been inculcated in us and nurtured. If we examine the doctrine strictly on a logical basis, we find it's premised on great leaps of logical supposition, which designate the will as a causal force, the ego as the cause of the will, and the ego one's self-nature as an uncaused cause for which one becomes responsible for themselves. That is, as if one had created himself and decided his own nature. This is a series of fallacious assumptions, which we're not at all permitted to make according to the facts at hand. It's nothing but an interpretation based on the attribution of imaginary causes, taking something that merely accompanies the event as the cause of the event. And Nietzsche, as he says, is an immoralist who's trying with all his strength to, quote, take the concept of guilt and the concept of punishment out of the world again, and to cleanse psychology, history, nature, and social institutions, end quote. As this is his goal, he must necessarily oppose himself to the doctrine of free will, which is the origin of that stain on the self-consciousness of nature, which is man. The last section of this chapter, the Four Great Errors, section 8, we can regard as Nietzsche's mission statement, so to speak. If all of these apparently self-evident beliefs are in fact errors, then what doctrine ought we take up instead? And he directly contrasts himself with the positions of Kant and Schopenhauer, who both questioned free will on a strictly logical basis, but appealed to two things: our intuition of free will, i.e., the way we think about ourselves and think about our actions, regardless of the truth of those thoughts, and also to the notion of intelligible freedom. That, in spite of the fact that we act in one way or another in accord with our own nature, meaning that apparently we simply are one way or another, man must have had a freedom to be this or that kind of person. There must be some kind of choice prior to the realization of one's nature. And Nietzsche implies that this is because we've always held a more basic and blatantly false prejudice, but one which nevertheless colors our thinking, that man is the effect of some special purpose or some special destiny. This kind of thinking is right in line with our entire concept of being, which draws these lines of separation between subject and object, between cause and effect, between one phenomena and another. That man is divided from the rest of nature as a special, quote-unquote, thing, a special case, something capable of attaining the ideal of humanity, the ideal of happiness, the ideal of morality. But Nietzsche argues, quote, the fatality of his essence is not to be disentangled from the fatality of all that has been and will be. End quote. The counter-doctrine, then, to free will, and to the entire doctrine of causality, which includes even the refutation of free will, the doctrine of determinism, all of this is to be dismissed in the face of Nietzsche's new doctrine of fate. This is why I tend to call Nietzsche's view fatalism, in which all apparently separate things and events are part of a vast tapestry. And this isn't like a mechanistic series of billiard balls clacking into one after the other in a chain of causes and effects that must either end in the absurdity of an infinite regress or the equal absurdity of an uncaused cause. And we might say, by the way, the infinite regress absurdity is found in determinism, and the uncaused cause absurdity is found in the libertarian free will doctrine. That is what the debate is between. No, Nietzsche's not having any of this, because to even create that image of existence as a chain, a series of links, is to draw arbitrary divisions. From our human perspective, which informs us not one bit about the nature of human independent reality, create all of these separate categories and then call them beings or existence or causes and effects. And in this way, Nietzsche rebukes Kant while retaining his influence from the neo-Kantians, which is with Nietzsche all the way from the beginning of his career. He carries forward that intuition that causality is not something, quote-unquote, out there in an objective world. It's something which happens at the intersection of human perception and the so-called external world. It's something that is useful for us as an interpretive framework, even though it may be a false framework for all that. We'll now look at the final paragraph of the chapter, the conclusion of the four great errors. Quote, "One is necessary. One is a piece of fatefulness. One belongs to the whole. One is in the whole. There is nothing which could judge, measure, compare, or sentence our being, for that would mean judging, measuring, comparing, or sentencing the whole. But there is nothing besides the whole. That nobody is held responsible any longer. That the mode of being may not be traced back to a causa prima. That the world does not form a unity, either as a sensorium or as a spirit. That alone is the great liberation. With this alone is the innocence of becoming restored. The concept of God was until now the greatest objection to existence. We deny God. We deny the responsibility in God. Only thereby do we redeem the world." End quote. To want one aspect of fate to be different is to want the whole thing to be different. The entire interplay of forces would be altered by one force disappearing or changing its course or intensity. And yet reality is not to be conceived as a unity, as a monism, in the way that, say, many of the early pre-Platonics thought that reality could be conceived. No, Nietzsche is with the pluralists, and he's with Heraclitus. The one is the many. The many is not reducible to a one, but neither is any part of the many to be conceived as a cause unto itself, divided ontologically from the rest of the many. The many remains a many, not the subject divided from the world of objects. Nietzsche's fatalism therefore dares us to accept a pluralistic reality, and every event within it, as absolutely necessitated by a non-purposive relation of forces. If we take that great leap of acceptance, of regarding every piece of fate as necessary, we affirm the entirety of the great play of becoming. And if one does this, then imputing guilt or responsibilities to some portion of it would be just another absurdity, because every other part which we affirm and call good can only exist in relation to those parts that we call bad. That we are to say, along with Spinoza, that the many modifications of existence, the various phenomena, meaning animals, trees, mountains, lightning, flash floods, human beings, warfare, disease, weather patterns, all of it, can only be regarded as good or bad from the standpoint of our limited human reason, from the standpoint of one particular perspective. None of it is good or bad in and of itself, because to say that would be to deny the whole, the right of existence. In Nietzsche's eyes, this is the effect of the God doctrine, the idea of an eternal moral judge presiding over all being, being instantiated in our thought as an eternally existing form of consciousness, and an eternal moral law, which intercedes in existence, judges and condemns some, affirms and uplifts others, divides all the souls at the end of time into the good people and the bad people. This is not a healthy view of existence. It's an argument against existence, in fact, because it necessitates, as it were, a judgment passed against the world. If this world of nature and the people living in it, its states and empires, are to be judged from the absolute moral standard of Christianity, then the world must be deemed guilty. But we already know where this drive to call the world guilty comes from. Nietzsche suggests that this is where we should look to determine why it is that we would make such errors as those that we have considered. Once again, under our apparently cool-headed rationalist view of the world, we find what is ultimately religious. And that is true even of those of us who have formally left religion. These great errors still remain in our thought. That's all for this week, everyone. Thanks for joining me. I'm back at home from after being on tour. I was sick for a while. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. Maybe it gives my voice a little more roughness or grit, but I'm getting better. I'm improving. As many of you know, if you've been listening for a while, you usually get sick when you're on tour like that. But we've got 4 more episodes of this season coming out. I'm excited for every one of these. I think these are going to be really good. I'm happy with them regardless of what the reception is going to be, but I think it's going to be pretty good. All right, that's all. Signing off. If you enjoyed the Nietzsche podcast or found it helpful, you can visit us and support the show at patreon.com/untimelyreflections. The link is in the description. Or just share the show with any of your friends that you think might enjoy it or on social media. Thank you for your support.